Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no, how would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're covering nearly every aspect of the beautiful game as we debate points, penalties and the plans for an independent regulator. There'll be plenty of actual football too as we look at the young talent in Gareth Southgate's England squad and reflect on the Brazilian takeover of the Premier League from Janinho to Jesus. And joining me, Tom Clark, to discuss all of that, we have the chief correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, a former footballer who played at three international tournaments for Ireland, including the 1994 World Cup, which was won by Brazil, and another former footballer who has absolutely no connection with Brazil at all. But he did play in two thrillers against Belarus for Scotland under-21s, sadly losing both matches 3-2. Gregor Robertson will be bringing the Samba skills to the
did
podcast
I today.
Did
I score in one of them?
You did score in one of them, but yeah, okay. I think I've done the fact that you scored two
internationals.
I'm just trying to broaden it out. Now, Tony, I was looking at your career and I got very excited when I realised that Ireland had beaten Brazil in 1987, at the peak of your powers. But it turns out you weren't quite back in Jack Charlton's good books at that point.
No, I played three games under Owen Hand when I first got called up in about 85. And then I got a knee injury and Jack didn't select me. And then I'm playing one day for Millwall Elland Road in the Championship. And we won 2-1, played well, scored. And as I was going towards the dressing rooms, Jack was next to the away dressing room. So I've never met Jack before. And as I'm walking there, I could see him. And he went, "Hey, Kazza!" So I've looked at him. "Hey, Jack." "Yeah." "I watched you play for Gillingham. You were shit. Do you want to come back and play for Ireland?" I went, "Yeah, Jack." I sort of knew what Jack was like. I'd been told by a couple of other players who was there to just take everything with a pinch of salt with Jack. And but yeah, I got back in. I played again. My first game under Jack was against Poland. At Lansdowne Road, which is now the Aviva. But no, I missed that game, is the whole point, against Brazil. And that shirt would have been worth a fortune.
Yeah. But that's because you're a bit shit, apparently. So you've only got yourself to blame. Now, before we get back into the internationals of the current day, the big news which broke just after we'd recorded Monday's podcast was Nottingham Forest's four-point deduction for breaching financial losses. Charlotte Duncan breaking the news on the Times website of that decision that puts the club in the Premier League relegation zone. And Martin Ziegler following up with a story on the Times website that Forest might have to sell one of their star players to avoid further penalties. Now, points deductions and FFP, who could I throw to here? Oh, Martin Samuel, hi. Hey, here you are with us. All jokes aside, I am going to read your comment piece, just the intro, because I did find it very funny. The decision of the independent panel was known on Friday, but Nottingham Forest asked the Premier League to delay the announcement of the four-point deduction for fear it would affect the mood around Saturday's match against Luton Town. Look at them, still imagining that what happens on the field matters. It's quite sweet, really. Quite old school, caring about events on the field of play, the action the clubs still charge the fans to watch when everyone who runs the game has long moved on.
Yeah. Well, that's where we are. You know, I know everyone's trying to take credit for the lawyers and accountants thing now, but I've been saying it all season. I was reading it in Simon Jordan's column. I read it in, I read it in Matthew Syed's column. He wrote about lawyers and accountants, apparently. I don't know when that was, but a few weeks ago, maybe. Some of us have been there a little bit earlier. But anyway, lawyers and accountants, yeah. In charge of the game. But that's where it is. It's the Times. It's a middle-class newspaper, I get that. But it's a working-class sport. And gradually, it's being eroded. That the working class part of it is the sweaty footballers part of it, and that part of the game is being eroded. And Alan Hudson called it the working class ballet, didn't he? And I've always subscribed to that idea. I've always subscribed to footballers for the amusement of the working class and a sport of the working class. And it's the best sport because it's the easiest sport to understand and the easiest sport to play. And if you've got if you've got two jumpers, you've got a game, and if you've got four jumpers, you've got a match. And I love that about football. And it pains me that I spend all of my time now writing about financial regulations and financial punishments and taking points off teams. And the Nottingham Forest thing, there's so many better ways of dealing with this,
like what?
Than taking 4 points off them. Transfer embargoes, all of that side of it. What's happened with Forest? Forest haven't had a parachute payment in, I want to say, about 20 years. They would have had a parachute payment, but it would have started in the last century because they haven't been in the league since 1999. Gregor, am I right in this?
I think it was 23 years out of the league.
Yeah, 23 years out of the league. Now, how they are hidebound by the same financial regulations as a Manchester United or Arsenal who've never been out the top division, how there isn't some leeway that allows Nottingham Forest, when they come into the league, 2 or 3 years to try to get themselves competitive without this punitive punishment, I don't know, because it just seems so straightforward to me. It just seems so simple.
So you think Nottingham Forest deserves to be punished in some way, but not... Not with
I'm not even sure they deserve to be punished. But if you've got a set of rules, you've got a set of rules. I've always said that. It's like the Man City thing. You've got a set of rules, you've got a set of rules. But I think the rules are flawed. And I certainly think the rules with regards to promoted teams are just not thought through. Because everything should be about trying to make the promoted teams competitive. And I've argued on here before... That's what a parachute payment does. It gives you a £40 million kitty that you can spend because you're going to get it back if it doesn't work. But more than that, how can they have the same limitations as clubs that have been established for decades in this league? How can you come in and they go, all right, well, you've got to be competitive, but here's your budget limit, and it's the same as a club that's had 25 years of Premier League money.
Gregor, your former club, Nottingham Forest?
Yeah, I mean, Martin made some really good points in that column. It's like, I kind of read that idea about promoted clubs being judged by different sort of parameters and rules. I found that quite persuasive. I think there's an argument for that.
But the key being promoted clubs who haven't gone down and come back again.
Also, if you're allowing clubs who go up to spend more, then you're also it opens up the conversation again about the gulf between the divisions and how important it is to keep that as narrow as possible. Because if they're allowed to spend freely when they come up and they still go back down, they're in a world of pain. Particularly if, as is likely, parachute payments are going to be are on the way out. So. Oh, like having said all that, I'm kind of in the same position as I was with Everton, in that we can have a broader debate about the rules and their merits, but the rules existed, and like Everton, Forest have been run really badly. They didn't have to sign 40 odd players in 3 transfer windows, 30 of which were in the first season. You know, and this whole debate about the time that Brennan Johnson was sold, but you know. Because the tax, the sort of end of the financial accounting period ends end of June, and obviously the transfer window closes at start of September. They were kind of getting low-ball offers for Brennan Johnson before, and they felt like we have to hold on to try and get another 15, 20 million pounds or whatever. If you just didn't buy 10 of those other players that were a complete waste of money, you wouldn't be left in that position where you're having to rely on the income of selling one of your crown jewels. You know, a lot of people they wouldn't want to sell him either. No. You know, they knew that they had to sell Brennan Johnson because they wasted all this other money. That's been Forest history for so long as well. Like, Forest fans listening to this will know that. Particularly since Evangelos Marinakis has come in. Like, they have wasted a ridiculous amount of money. They've signed over 100 players. This didn't just start when they were promoted. It's just that it's become to the kind of... The country's attention since they were promoted, the waste was happening in the Championship. Always, every transfer window, ridiculous number of players come in, and then they sell a player from the academy often to kind of cover the losses. So I have very little sympathy for Forest owners, Forest custodians. I have sympathy for the fans, but I have very little sympathy for Forest as a club.
A personal story for me was the way I joined Marseille and the circumstances around Marseille when they were champions of Europe in 93. In 94, I'm joining the club. The club had got relegated and they had an owner called Bernard Tapie who done what he liked. Mm. He was a wealthy man. He ignored the day of the day, but will handle whatever happens a year and a half later.
Right.
Okay, thinking he could always find a way around it. So I was really intrigued, and I talked about Martin's column on Monday about the lawyer thing. Yeah. So I was always intrigued about and concerned about lawyers and regulators all having their pennies worth in football and how dangerous it can get. And I saw at Marseille firsthand of how the club had to re-establish itself, and they had to abide by new rules, which was I came on a free and they could only take free transfers. So they then got 10 free transfers. They had to stay under a certain cap. We got to the end of the season. We got promoted. As we got promoted, we were demoted again because without us all knowing, the club had again done things they shouldn't have during that course of that season. So I experienced really two demotions down, you know, two relegations, shall I say. And I saw the effects of how it affected the club, the town and everything. And there was a lot of sympathy for Marseille to a degree, but it was inflicted by an owner who'd really... The Forest owner must have sort of... Well, to me, it's like, I'll go and do what I need to do and you lot can handle, whoever I employ can sort out, out 18 months down the line. Mm. And then you're left with a scenario of where Forest are today. It bothers me the way it's been handled because I do feel like the club... I don't like points deductions. When you say embargo, I get that much more. I even think you can take a percentage of their revenue. So like Man City earned $712 million last year. You can fine them. If you're paying... Obviously, if you're overspending, that's money. Well, hit them with a fine that will be maybe 10% of your revenue.
Mm.
They just have more options I just don't like points deductions.
Just quickly, because obviously we're talking about some big topics here, but how did that feel as a player at Marseille?
Because I never knew what was happening.
Was it unsettling in terms of playing?
We were going into a season, people are telling us, you've got to win, because if you don't win and get promoted, you're going down again. So now the whole club is like, well, we could be in League 3, League One in England.
Yeah.
You could be in League One in England, and no one's got a clue what's going to happen with that because half the team, if not half, nearly everybody would be gone, even if you've done well. So I'm really conscious of the effects on a football club by points and deduct. I mean, Luton is the most ridiculous
Luton
story
is
of
the
all.
Miracle.
It's the most ridiculous story ever, how they got punished, nearly at the end. What was
points.
It? 40? Well, it's 40 in total by the end. Yeah. But, so I see it. And I find lawyers and all this...
Yeah, it does feel like there are junctures in sort of in history.
Yes.
And we're at one now. You know, that was one with Luton, and Luton were a team who fell foul of a moment in time when the FA... really wanted to clamp down on things.
Masterful.
And this is another period in time where the Premier League are trying to do the same. They're trying to bare their teeth. Like the mistake, clearly one of the biggest mistakes is not having clear sanctions. But again, the clubs decided that. We always have to remember that the Premier League is a members body. Same with the EFL. The clubs decided not to have clear sanctions in place. And now they're complaining when the sanctions aren't maybe consistent as they thought they should be.
They're random, aren't they? I mean, Everton was 10 points and Forest was 4 points. Forget that Everton ended up at 6 points. It was 10 points. And I totally take Gregor's points about Forest being badly run. But you can't ever guarantee that the chairman knows what he's doing. You can't ever guarantee that every club runs smartly. And you look at Forest, the whole point about Forest, you want to know the punishment for Forest. Forest were fighting relegation before they got deducted 4 points because buying 43 players is a really stupid way to run a football club. And leaving yourself having to sell your best player to afford 20 players that aren't in his league is a stupid way to run a football club. Football clubs find ways of punishing themselves if they're badly run. They really do. And that's why this idea that you've got to keep deducting points off of, keep deducting points. In the end, and that was my point about the Forest piece, with the Forest piece, what you see on the pitch, if you want to charge people money to watch that on the pitch, it can't be that you watch that on the pitch and then none of it matters because there was a meeting in Chambers and it ended up as a 10-point deduction. 4 points is more than you can get for winning any football match.
Yeah.
Liverpool could have beat Man City 20-0. They wouldn't have got 4 points out of it. And so I just look at this and it's moving away from football all the time, moving away from football. And because I write about this stuff all the time, because it does truly bother me, and people go, oh, why don't you write about football? All you ever write about is this. And you go, no. It's because I like football so much. Mm. That's why I write about this. Mm. Because all I can see is I grew up watching football and no one knew who the chairman was, let alone knew what his spending limit was. You didn't know who the chairman was. You know, I grew up in an era where West Ham got relegated and everyone stayed behind for an hour, solid, like Burks, singing Johnny Lyle's Claret and Blue Army. Because it never occurred to us that we should sack our manager. Johnny Lyle was West Ham. He was as good as we were going to get. Why shouldn't he try and take us out of the second division? And that's what football was like. And I'm sorry if I sound like a dinosaur, but no one at the end of it went, oh, by the way, not only have you got relegated, you've spent too much money getting relegated as well, so we're going to deduct your 4 points if you ever get back, which is the sort of situation that Leicester are finding themselves in. Not only have they got relegated, they've spent too much money getting relegated. So if they come back, they'll get deducted points so they can get relegated again. And if you tell me that is where football is, you're like, really? Because that really wasn't what I thought I was watching.
Well, speaking of relegation, because obviously we're talking about some big themes and we're going to come on to some other big themes with the independent regulator. Looking at the table now, Tony.
The Forest... independent regulator, by the way, is not the most important thing.
No, but we're
we know is the most important
thing.
Mate.
You're getting teed much up. You're more getting teed
important
up.
Don't worry.
I'm going to side foot the ball to you across the 6 yard line and you're going to tap it in.
Yeah.
But before that, Tony, on the relegation front, fifth Forest, you just talked then about Marseille and the effect it had on you. I've asked you before about Everton and their points deduction. You felt that they would generally be fine.
Mm.
How do you feel about Forest now looking at the table?
As a team.
As players and the idea of relegation.
I spoke on Sunday my piece for Monday that about, you know, all this that's going
their
on.
Troubles and on the pitch.
They've got issues as in the way they defend set pieces. You know, they're conceding so many points. I mean, we talk about a 4-point deduction.
Yeah.
The amount of deduction they've had from set pieces is hilarious. Every time I see Forest play, I keep thinking
43 players and no one knows how to clear a ball.
Exactly. And I just find it, look, they look like a team to me that are absolutely fine as long as they can handle set pieces. Because if they do, they're mid-table for us, for me.
Right.
I like Iwanye. I think he's a good player. I think, you know, Hudson-Odoi, one side, Morgan Gibbs-White. You know, you look at their team, you think Alanga. Mm. There's a danger there. They can counter brilliantly. And there's a pretty good basis of a side. But if you're going to, you know, get things wrong in certain things in football, you could, you know, look at why Luton... why have they been the best of the three that came up? It's purely set pieces. They are the most likely to score because they're very good at the lad Morris gets on the end of things, the deliveries comes in.
Exactly,
got great deliveries of a ball. That's enabled them to have a chance to stay up.
Yeah.
But if you're telling me Forest and Luton, who are the better side and who are way more quality, I'd say Forest.
Yeah.
But one's way more organised than the other.
If Forest had bought 20 players rather than 43, when you're reeling off those individual players, and you think, right, if they'd have bought 20 players that would be manageable for any, you know, for Steve Cooper and now for Nuno, that would be manageable, they could be a mid-table team because, you know, 20 of the players aren't bad, you know, or 11 of the players aren't bad. It's the rest of them that have complicated everything for them.
Yeah. Greg, a final word from you on that point about relegation and the team and how this obviously affects it quite literally with the points deduction, but mentally as well, how you look at your former club going into the end of the season if this 4 points stands.
Yeah, I think I kind of agree with Tony. I think that you look at them and you think I think Nuno's done a decent job. They've not actually probably quite got the points that they deserved, as much as they've bleated on about the refereeing decisions. They have been on the on the end of some unfortunate ones. Rotted. I think probably they should have had more points than they've won since Nuno's come in. So you would think they've got enough, but it's going to be for the reasons Tony suggests. That, you know, despite the kind of the speed on the attack and the creativity they have, they're not scoring a lot of goals, and they are still shipping some at the other end. So I think it'll probably be quite tight.
Tight, I'm sure it will be. Now, another story which came out after we recorded Monday's show was from Martin Ziegler. Intro'd the clubs will fall foul of the new independent regulator could be fined up to 10% of their annual turnover. So Tony Cascarino, looks like they're nicking ideas from you. But more important than that, and he's had a refreshment from his squeaky water bottle, and now Martin Samuel is going to introduce us to a new term in football lawmaking.
Right.
Anchoring.
Anchoring, right. So anchoring is the future. It's all right, the regulator, we've known that wasn't coming for a long, long time. And
still worth talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's still worth talking about, absolutely. Actually, I nicked all of my ideas, by the way. The government regulator is ridiculous. I mean, the safeguarding the badge, the safeguarding the ground, safeguarding the colours, safeguarding the location, it's all nicked out of a column I wrote. I mean, started so about the first one was about 12 years ago. The most recent one was during COVID when the Super League thing came along. It's all Nick. I'm telling you now. But anyway,
we're not talking
she's
about
a lovely person,
ago.
Tracy. I like Tracy, but it's
we're
great.
We're talking about your column from Tuesday.
Yeah,
which
from Tuesday
brings us back to anchoring
and Sunday. Yeah, I know you want me to. You know,
you
now,
wanted to. You were going
well, mate, I'm totally. I mean, Matthew Syed, I read online this morning. You can't read it in the paper. But Matthew Syed wrote this morning that his, you know, I think he said his eyes were glazing over reading it. So now he knows how I feel when I have to read his column. And
Matthew will be with us next week.
Yes, good. Please invite him. You've got to see the reaction of the studio. I wish you could see the reaction of the studio, listeners. I really wish we could.
Hammering it sounds more like.
You've given it the big.
Anyway,
you've given it the big. We need to talk about anchoring.
Right,
and here I come.
Right.
I've slalomed all the way into the box. I've dodged your weird tackle.
I'm not even sure listeners will know what anchoring is.
Right, I'm going to explain it all. So, the new proposal, the one that is being considered, is part of a big document. I wrote about it. I've written about it a couple of times now, and it will anchor the leading club to a 4.5 times multiple of the broadcast revenue of the bottom club. It's up for discussion. It might not be the broadcast revenue. It could be their turnover. But obviously the turnover is something that is variable. There's a great deal of debate about the legitimacy, for instance, of Manchester City's turnover. So if you want to make it something finite, they make it the broadcast revenue. And on the face of it, sounds... You think, oh, that's a good idea. That increases competition, and that brings the gap between the haves and have-nots in, and that's something I've always been in favour of. However, one of the things that is, if you put a ceiling like that 4.5 times, what it means is, no matter what you do, you can't increase your revenue. You can't increase the capital at your disposal. So, one, there is less pressure on a club to run itself really well, to come up with smart ideas, to come up with, you know, there's less because you don't. And also, winning doesn't make as much difference because if you can only go at a 4.5 times multiple of, say, Luton or Sheffield United, you could win something like the Club World Cup, and that's £100 million. And that doesn't matter. That actually doesn't go into your revenue stream. So what is going to happen? We are going to go back to the good old days if you were owning a football club in the 1950s, where you had a maximum wage of a tenner, 6p to get in, 70,000 people in the stadium. Where did the money go?
Mm.
Well, it went straight to the board of directors, the owners, the chairman, and everything. And that's what happens now. If I was being cynical, and God forbid, I would say that certain clubs wanted to form a European Super League and move into the financial stratosphere that way, i.e. the people who invested in the club moving into the financial stratosphere, and that got thwarted. Well, how do you get that money? Well, I know what we'll do. If we can only spend 4.5 times what Luton Town get from the TV, that's our money.
European then Super League money was 55% of turnover or something.
Yeah, like something like that. Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
So that's the same idea, you're right.
Yeah. Like, it's
essentially there was a profit to be gleaned from.
There was a profit. And this is my point, and profit and sustainability, P&S, right? Sustainability, I'm all in favour of. Love a bit of sustainability in this side of the table. Where's the profit? Why are we all concerned so much that everyone...
It should be a good thing.
It's a good thing, but what I mean is, yeah. No one has ever huddled around a cup of Bovril at half-time going, I do hope the chairman makes a profit out of this club this year. I really do hope he gets paid a massive dividend and saws it. Because funnily enough, when that was happening to the Glazers at Manchester United, nobody seemed very happy with that at all when the Glazers were creaming off the top. Nobody seemed very happy with Mike Ashley at Newcastle when it looked like he might make a profit. So why are we suddenly so obsessed that everyone has got to make a profit as well as be sustainable? Sustainability is great. Yeah, make sure the club doesn't go skint. But this idea now we're going to make a profit, well... I'm not as fussed about that.
But yeah, Martin makes a good point, because like how finely balanced like this is in football, and that we don't want huge losses because it threatens the future of football clubs, and or it can, and we don't also want the owners of football clubs. It feels inherently wrong. Something feels wrong about the owner of a football club making a profit, or as Martin says,
but even when
drawing dividends.
But there's massive money in football, and it has been for such a long time, with TV deals, sponsorship, everything like that. So why would there not be a profit aspect?
Because it feels wrong.
I don't mind a profit. I don't actually, you know, the Peter Mandelson thing, I don't mind people getting filthy rich. I really don't. But we are trying to embed it. So, you know, profit and sustainability, it's got to be about profit. And so, well, why has it got to be about profit?
It was about...
Rich egomaniacs.
So say Brighton just now.
Yeah,
they're in profit because they are brilliant in the transfer market, and no one will begrudge. Like Tony Bloom's not drawing money out, but
absolutely.
No one would begrudge Brighton being in a really sound financial state and the potential. You know, they are in profit. No one begrudges them that because they're run really smartly. But as Martin's saying, it's different if you're kind of rigging the system so that there is always a profit to be gleaned by being the owner of a football club.
Yeah.
By being a billionaire who can afford to buy a football club and then draw the profit out of...
Because there's a ceiling on what you can spend. This is what I mean. There's then a finite ceiling, and winning stuff doesn't matter. Or coming up with a multi-club platform that takes off around the world or whatever. That doesn't matter. Nothing that you do gets you out of that multiple.
Right.
I always seem to go personal on stuff that I've experienced and conversations, but I did a study a few years back on profit by football clubs, and I was alarmed that the profit was so low. And I found it intriguing that clubs, really big clubs, would have like just thousands of pounds of profit, not millions like you'd think. And they're global companies, you know, like really. And I kept thinking, oh, this is weird. And that obviously there's huge tax revenue to be paid by the salaries that everybody as an employee of a football club. And then I had a conversation with Doug Ellis at Villa, and it was when I signed, and he said, look, it's the end of March, it's the old March deadline day. He said, we've got £2 million to spend. He said, I'm going to buy a centre forward. So if I don't buy you, I'm going to buy somebody else. He said, because I'm not going to give the tax man on profit of the football club. Clubs don't have profit because if they have, they pay tax. So they'll rather go and buy another player, which makes logical sense, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you get £50 million profit. I mean, I'm sure Tony Bloom's can diverse or...
Absolutely,
profit,
He
can use his profit.
Man U's based in the Cayman Islands, aren't they?
No, but I'm
like
sure
that
he
the
can...
amortisation as well, we're back to that. They won't get all the money.
Well, his training ground, the improvements to a ground. Look, without going off track, it basically was telling me that the profit thing was not a big deal for a football club.
No.
It's not a big deal because... They just see it as they just regenerate all the time with their squads, with their club, their new training grounds. Everything they do is basically to lose money. So I just think
it's always been a business where the owner should be duty bound to reinvest any profit that they make.
Yeah.
That's what football fans feel.
Yes.
So as Martin's saying, this is like the Super League thing. This is a way
we
of...
We can take this off the top now, and that's our money.
Exactly.
I would now say that this is a time we should speak about the independent regulator, though, because surely this would be something that would be a backstop.
At what? I'm not convinced by the independent regulator. But I'm not even convinced.
But we're leaving the power.
All of that fond rhetoric this week about taking it off bad club, you know, taking the club off of bad owners. Not one of my ideas. I'm not even, if you read it, you've virtually got to set fire to the stadium and run through the streets naked to get the club taken off you. You really have. I mean, it doesn't, people invest a lot. I appreciate that they do. But people are investing a lot in the government regulator idea. It doesn't want to look at the Nottingham Forest and Everton cases. They've already made that clear. And when you read that little part of it, if I hadn't switched my phone off because I've got it on there, I would read it out to you. I've always called it a government regulator. A lot of people call it independent regulator. I've always called it the government regulator. And I was very pleased this week to read in it that there's a part of it that says, how the regulator will act is in accordance with government policy, because that means it's not an independent regulator, it's a government regulator. So I was very, very pleased that I'd framed that right for several years. And I just think we're all looking at it thinking, oh, this will do this, it will do this. It's like VAR. VAR, everyone thought VAR would do whatever they wanted it to do. They would just agree with me all the time. You know, this is a great thing with VAR. I thought that goal was offside. VAR will clearly think that goal was offside as well, and I'll be very, very happy. And then it turns out the VAR thinks the exact opposite to what you think half the time, and you're still just as furious anyway, apart from you've waited 5 minutes to be furious. Well, the government regulators, I think it will disappoint in the same way, Greg. I really do. Because when people say it would have stopped Newcastle owning Saudi Arabia owning Newcastle.
I don't think that's true, no.
Saudi Arabia would have owned Newcastle about 10 minutes after the bid if the government had been involved, trust me.
Is it not more about it would have stopped Bury going out of business, or it would have stopped Macclesfield going out of business?
I would hope it would, but I'm still not sure it would, because when I look at those powers, what's got to be triggered for you to actually walk in and go, right, give us the keys, mate.
Get out,
and we'll tell you when we've sold the club. Dai Young at Reading, for instance, this would have prevented Reading, right? I was reading, I think it was Kevin Miles, the Football Supporters Federation, this would have prevented another Reading. Would it? Hell. At the time Dai Young bought Reading, our government was, it was just after, it was Brexit. I think it's the Brexit year. Mm. Our government was absolutely desperate to get Chinese investment in this country. Desperate. It's all around that time that Wolves, that West Brom, I'm forgetting a good couple of others.
Villa as well.
Villa. That all of these clubs was sold to Chinese investors. The government would have been 100% behind that. It just might get him out of the club now. I'm not convinced, but it might just get him out of the club now. But certainly at the time, it would not have stopped him taking over Reading. It would have been encouraged.
I think probably, I think he tried to also buy Hull when they were in the Premier League, and the Premier League
nixed it.
Said no.
Yeah.
So I think probably the suggestion is that I'm more kind of beefed up. Though even that phrase, it's hard. It's hard to know who's fit and who's not until they've owned the club and start to run it into the ground. No one's disputing that. What I'm saying is, two stories from this week. The one that Martin's talking about anchoring, and the complete collapse of the new deal. You know, the wealth redistribution model between the Premier League and the rest of the Football League. Mm. Those two stories fundamentally, for me, just underline the fact that we need some sort of protection. We need some sort of backstop. The trajectory is more and more power concentrated in the hands of a few wealthy billionaires who are greedy. All they want is more power, more wealth, as Martin's story this week underlines. So if you have... it might not be perfect, but to have some level of backstop to that, some level of protection, I would absolutely take it than not. And then, you know, if the Premier League and the Football League can't come to an agreement, then let's have someone else in there mediate and saying, we need to narrow the gap between the leagues. We need to, because it's an ecosystem. Football is, fundamentally, when we're talking about, you know, everyone also thinks that this is going to be something that that hampers the strength of the Premier League and, like, you know, diminishes its supremacy and stuff. Even if that were true, which I don't think it is, I would still sacrifice a bit of that for the health of the pyramid as a whole. And that's my fundamental, like, start point in this conversation.
Martin, final word for you on this, on some of Gregor's points.
Final word, are you sure?
Final word for this episode.
I understand. I like the pyramid. I liked 50%, 25%, 12.5%, 12.5%. But that, you know, that horse is well gone over the horizon. And funnily enough, the bloke that now is representing the EFL was the guy that got rid of it, Rick Parry. But I liked that. I like that when, you know, half of the money went through the league and we kept a healthy pyramid. But that's gone. Sadly, it's gone.
You can narrow the gap.
But I totally get that.
You've got David Sullivan this week saying Tesco doesn't subsidise the corner shop. Tesco doesn't need the corner shop. Mm. What was the most exciting thing post lockdown about when the season resumed? It was the relegation battle. Mm. If you don't have a healthy relegation battle and clubs who are able to come up and not just be absolute patsies like we've seen this season, you're diminishing the product itself. So you need a healthy ecosystem. You need a healthy pyramid.
Gregor, I totally agree. And the scandal with that when it reconvened, the clubs at the top that were insisting there was a relegation battle are the same clubs exactly. that were insisting that those clubs at the bottom shouldn't get anywhere near us the money because no one cares about them. So you're like, hold on, no one cares about us, but if we haven't got relegation, you think no one will watch the league.
Is that not an advert for the truth, the fact that self-regulation has failed?
Gregor, what was that word you said again? Prax? The word you said just now, was it a praxy or something?
Praxy.
You said something like a word. Sorry, I'm gone on. You said a word. Was it a Scottish word? A real praxy. The team's
a patsy. Patsy.
Oh, right. Patsy. I was thinking, what's a patsy?
No, a patsy.
It may not be the right word. You know what I'm saying? They're like, they've got no chance.
Returning to Tony's point, not the one about Patsy, but the.
Don't bring Patsy.
Lovely girl. No, she's a lovely girl. But his point about the players, that's the whole. And profit. That's the whole point. The player aspect of it. The club, the people at the top are desperate to stop this, what they call prune juice money. Alan Sugar coined the phrase prune juice money. It comes in at one end from the broadcasters and goes straight out the other because you give it all to the players. Yeah, great. They're the ones who are playing the game.
I wholeheartedly agree.
They're the ones who are playing the game. So great. So the broadcast money goes up. That means the job that those players are doing is great and watchable and really, really good. So you give them the money, great. And then the broadcast money goes up because we get better players and then more people want to watch it. And so the broadcast money goes up again. So you give it to the players. And that's what you do. And I don't care less that the board is not making a profit. Good, give it to Erling Haaland.
Or give it to...
Mo Salah.
Or give it to more of the pyramid and to facilities around the country. Footballers don't need to earn £300,000 a week. I'm okay with them doing it. But if we're always looking for growth, there needs to be a point where you go, look, like, we're already miles ahead of every other league.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to pay someone £500,000 a week. Why don't distribute a bit of the wealth a little bit. But when you've got billionaire owners, when you've got owners who want to take a profit, they don't want to think about giving money to the EFL.
I need a bell to start doing it.
Many years ago, I wrote a column and I said it then, I still believe it. The TV deal should be negotiated in its entirety, and if the people in charge of football really had imagination, you don't need Sky, you don't need BT, you don't a TNT or whatever they're called, you don't need any of them. You do it yourself. You negotiate the whole, you set up your own television channel and you are Sky and you are TNT and you create the whole thing. You call it the pyramid. Every single club involved, you can see their matches. Every single club that's involved gets a little bit of the gravy, a little bit of the time. And instead of giving money to Accrington Stanley. Accrington Stanley are part of the equation. They are part of it. They have to work for their money. They have to do, you know, there's a 2-hour, you know, there's an hour documentary on Accrington Stanley that week or whatever. And it's 24 hours and it runs and you control it. And you don't need them, us, really. You don't need any of it. You can control it. And you, all of English football is encompassed in it. Yeah. And I've always thought that was the way forward. And the ridiculous thing about anchoring to the broadcast revenue, the most foolish thing about anchoring to the broadcast revenue, how much longer is TV going to be the main revenue stream, media-wise, for football clubs? Mm. And you've anchored to, it's like us anchoring to the circulation run of the Times.
Yeah.
You know, when the whole future of this industry is digital and it's modern electronic media. And the circulation and the paper, newspaper, newsprint is all still part of it, but over time it will cease to be. Yeah. So at the moment you wouldn't go, right, well, we'll anchor our calculations and our future to the print circulation run of the Times. You wouldn't do it anymore. So what are you doing anchoring to a multiple of broadcast revenue when that is unlikely to be the future of the industry?
Well, there you go, listeners. I did tell you we'd be covering absolutely everything on this show. We brought corner shops, Tesco, and even poor old Patsy came into it as well.
Yeah,
but if you've got strong views on Nottingham Forest or the regulator, then you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Stick with us. We've got some actual football coming up next with England against Brazil.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robertson. Now, England begin their final preparations for Euro 2024 on Saturday when they face Brazil at Wembley. Are we excited about this one, Martin?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Brazil. Why wouldn't you be excited?
Absolutely. And one other thing to get England fans excited is Kobbie Mainoo, the Manchester United youngster who's forced his way into the squad, partly due to injuries. And, you know, these kind of friendlies do throw up the opportunities for Gareth Southgate to test some people. Mm. But he's in there on merit, isn't he, Martin?
Totally. I'd have him in the team.
In the team?
I'd have him in the team, yeah. I'd start him.
For the Euros?
You've got to see how he plays against Brazil.
No, sorry,
first.
I didn't.
I was clarifying
what you were saying. Sorry.
Well, I would have him in the team.
You'd start him against Brazil.
I would have him in the team for these two matches to see if we could play him in the Euros, because I think that second central defensive position, if we're going to call Declan Rice a central defender,
central midfielder.
Central defensive midfielder,
CDM,
I think the modern parlance is if you played FIFA. Oh, God, if we're going to call, Declan Rice a CDM.
Yeah.
Is that not the medicinal cannabis?
I knew you were going. I could see you going.
Is that not the medicinal cannabis? CDM?
I was thinking, where's he going? CBD.
CBD.
So I've heard. Anyway.
Oh, I thought CBD.
I'm going to need some medicinal cannabis after this.
I thought CBD was Central Business District. Anyway, so
CDMs. Kobbie Mainoo.
Right, Kobbie Mainoo. Right. So We need someone to play alongside Declan Rice. If we're going to call Declan Rice a CDM, then it usually needs two. And I don't I'm not sure we've got one. I thought it could be Jordan Henderson. It wasn't Jordan Henderson's fault that Ajax got beat 4 by Villa last week, because he had his teammates sent off and they went down to 10 and stuff. I thought he played quite well against Villa in the first leg. But I'm still not sure now. If you look at the European Championships, group stages notwithstanding, sooner or later you've got to start playing some seriously good teams. Sooner or later, that is going to go to Champions League knockout level. That's what you'll be facing. You'll be facing a team that is a Champions League knockout stage level international team. Italy, Spain, France, Portugal, Germany, all of those, Holland. And then I'm not sure that Jordan has quite got the legs and the capacity for it anymore. And so we need someone. If Trent Alexander-Arnold was fit, I'd say play Trent Alexander-Arnold in midfield for two matches and see what we've got there. Because we know what we've got from Jordan. We really do. You don't need to see Jordan Henderson next to Declan Rice, because we saw that. That was at the World Cup in 2022. We saw that. We know what we know how that works. So I would play Minor.
So you had a plethora of central defensive options. You might even say John Stones could be another option.
You
need him in defence.
No,
though,
you don't. Yeah,
yeah, so he's so valuable, isn't he? Yes. I mean, I've read articles by people saying, "Oh, you play John Stones in there like Man City do," and you think, "Yeah." So you've solved that problem, and you've now created another one. So I'd really love to see Minor start.
Well, speaking of defence, Gregor, coming onto that and looking at that area, Lewis Dunk in the squad, Jared Branthwaite called up, Joe Gomez back in the squad. What is your reading on those kind of players? Are they contenders, or is this a bit of it's a friendly, we'll give them a chance, but they're not probably going to the Euros?
I think Joe Gomez will go to the Euros because of the problems at
versatility
at left
as
back.
Well.
And he's played 4 positions this season, I think. So he'll go. I think Branthwaite and Dunk are on trial.
Yeah,
I think one of them could go, but that's your problem area in the whole team. Like, although we're talking about, you know, who's the player alongside Declan Rice, there are options, and you have, even if it was Jordan Henderson, you wouldn't go in thinking, "Oh God."
Do you agree?
He's experienced.
Do you agree with Martin about Mainoo? Would you give him? Would you start?
Absolutely, yeah. Crikey, now he's in, and the way he performed in the in the FA Cup game there, most times he's played. In fact, he's got a bit of everything. And as I said the other week, I think there's more to come as well. We see, although he's playing in that position, he's got the ability to carry the ball forward. He's got, he's got a decent passing range. He's got good feet. He's technically good. He's a proper modern day centre midfielder, box to box number. But he's got those dense defensive attributes that make him so valuable as well. So absolutely, have a look at him. And I think without kind of something going disastrously wrong, I think he's probably going to go.
Mm. I was interested in Paul Hurst, who spoke about Mainoo in a piece this morning in the paper. And, his breakthrough season. And if you'd have said to him at the start of this year, you can play a lot of game for Man United and you're going to get called up for England when you're a teenager. I think we have a fear of bringing... It all stems back to the Theo Walcott idea. It wasn't a bad idea to select him. It was a bad idea the way he was used for me. Because that's another story. But I do believe if you go to South America and you're 18 and you look at numbers and you look at players' ability, you'll get selected. France have got Warren Zaïre-Emery, who's in the PSG team. He's a kid. He's just 18. He's just this month 18. Seen him play. And he's done a similar thing to Mainoo. He got in the team at the start of the season. He's in the PSG team. He's played for France already. And okay, it was against Gibraltar. But he's came in because he's so highly rated. And if I had a kid that age at 18 that was that good, I was lucky enough to see, and this is a different level because Ireland don't have a lot of established people that broke through, but I was in the dressing room when Damien Duff and Robbie Keane came in at 17. I remember talking to Quinny and we were laughing about, Robbie Keane, he's going to end our careers because we won't be in the team. He's 17.
Absolutely.
17 years old. And I remember thinking, these two are really good. really good. Training sessions with him, really good. Now, Manu's got the chance to operate in a training session and play and impress. If he impresses, and I'm like the boys, play him. I want to look at him in the international. Totally. Oh, my God. Totally. Your debut could be against Brazil.
Yeah.
No. You know what? You know, you're just giving the kid a real lift of going, your first game as an international winning kid would be against Brazil. That's a dream in itself, isn't it? So I would be so tempted to play him. And you know what? Every obstacle that he's been put in front of him, he's got over.
The only thing that makes you sort of like take a pause for a moment is that he wasn't selected initially.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously there were some there were some doubts in the manager's mind, though, about selecting
people
him.
Do that, Gregor, where they go, oh, we're trying to protect him. I'm thinking, protect him from what?
Exactly.
Protect him from what? If you look at English football over the last 20-odd years, 20, 30 years, two absolute revelatory players, revelatory moments, were both teenagers. Yeah. That became irresistible. Michael Owen, going towards the 1998 World Cup.
You're going Portugal next,
I think, and we'll go Portugal with really? Wayne Rooney, where Svengoor and Eriksson, when you're talking about, you know, oh, the media took these players up and all this. Sven compared him to Pelé in 2004, compared him to the impact that he saw Pelé have in Sweden in the 1958 World Cup. Mm. That was Sven's comparison. That wasn't a media thing. That was Sven's comparison. He thought the impact that Wayne had, which is why it was such a genius move to take him off against France when we were 1-0 up and then lose 2-1. But he compared his impact to that of Pelé in 1958. Michael Owen, that run against, it's against Poch, isn't it, where he just runs straight at him, and which is like a Jimmy Greaves move, where you just basically run almost straight at the centre-half and say, well, now what are you going to do with this? You know, those two players, I think more than anyone else, were in the team as teenagers and were brilliant. Because sometimes that's your absolute peak of playing without fear and of not worrying about it. And you would hope that Mainu, if he was selected against Brazil, wouldn't be sitting there worried that he was going to play against Brazil, would be thinking, what a chance, here we go, me and Declan Rice against Brazil. Right.
And Declan Rice has grown in stature too, even more this season, so it's like you think, oh, he's a young kid, and Declan Rice is kind of an old hand now. He's an experienced player. And
tell you where to go, tell you what to do.
I don't think you should be fear about that.
Just very quickly on the forward line, because there's an interesting conversations to be had around who plays with Harry Kane. Lots of different players are performing in different little peaks of moments this season, Tony. When it comes to the likes of Jared Bowen, Anthony Gordon, James Maddison, who are you kind of those three, who are you having top most likely to get in, get a chance?
Palmer in that conversation.
Well, Cole Palmer I slightly had in the midfield conversation a little bit further back. But yes, you could have Cole Palmer as well, definitely.
It's, I would think that probably the final squad, at least two of them would be gone, if maybe even three, out of Anthony Gordon,
Won't make it.
But he's grown up a lot this year. He's been really good when Newcastle have been at their best. So him, I'm not sure where Gareth is on Maddison. I'm not sure if he thinks he's got a 10 in his team. I'm not sure. I'd like to think so, because again, Maddison's a really gifted player.
Well, and if it is, it's Jude Bellingham, isn't it? If
he's I would have added to that you can certainly push Jude Bellingham further forward. So it's a tough one. Bowen, I don't think will make the squad at all. Jared Bowen, even though he's reliable, I just think he won't make it.
I think with that debate there, we're talking about pick number 18, 19, 20, 21. I mean, it's Harry Kane, Jude Bellingham behind, Phil Foden there, and Bukayo Saka there.
Yeah.
And I can't see beyond that on form, on what they've given to England when they've been played. You know, and so what you're looking at is, well, who comes on as a sub with 20 minutes to go to shore it up?
Jack Grealish and Rashford are looking on a little bit shaky ground. They're so looking that's at why the ground. Conversation
so
is
so those
like
two guys are subs. But, you know, if we know Gareth, the person who probably comes on with 20 minutes to go is Jordan Henderson. I do think there's a lot of Roy, do you want a Roy Hodgson story? I can tell you a Roy Hodgson story. Roy Hodgson is, when he was manager of Switzerland, is sitting in his office, you know, burning the midnight oil or whatever. And Mike Kelly comes in. He said he's got his team, he's got his squad, he's got to name the squad. And Mike Kelly comes in, who's a goalkeeping coach ostensibly, but so much more. If you talk to anybody that knew or worked with Mike Kelly, they say he was so much more than just a goalkeeping coach. He was a great football mind, and one that Roy very much admired. And Mike comes in and he says to Roy, what are you doing? He said, well, I've got 19 players. He said, I'm just going round in circles. He said, on these, like, last four names. And Mike Kelly said, are they going to play? And Roy says, well, no, probably not, because he'd done the statistical research, yeah. and he discovered that the optimum number of players actually play in a World Cup, unless you've got a dead rubber and you put everyone else in, is 17. That's your squad, really, 17. Then you've got two goalkeepers, and then you've got four outfield players that don't get involved. And he said, well, no, probably not really. So Mike Kelly said, so pick four you like. And Roy Hodgson said, at the time, he said, I thought it was the most unprofessional thing I'd ever heard. He said, I couldn't believe that Mike had said it. He said, but having managed international squads, I now realise he was absolutely right. Those four guys, the four that aren't going to play unless you've got injuries in the same position or whatever, they need to be fellas that are good travellers, good team men, good squad men.
Positive.
That positive.
Connor Cody.
Stay positive, yeah. Stay this. Absolutely fantastic. And I can remember telling the anecdote and saying, this is why Frank Lampard is definitely in Roy Hodgson's squad, because he knows he will play that role. If he's not in the team, he will play that role, which is exactly what he did. And it's coming to this. So those four guys...
Henderson will be in
there. Well, that's what I mean.
Yeah.
So Jordan's in, because Jordan is exactly that sort of guy. If he's not in the team, sorry, he'll be great. He'll be great. That's why Ben White, after what happened in Qatar, it was always going to be the first guy to be discarded. And he probably knew that, which is why I said, oh, it's not for me anyway. Because he knows. Because if you're not a good traveller, if you're not a happy traveller, if you're not a happy camper... Well, if you're the third choice right back, you're going to be on the bench, let's be honest, unless we have a run of bad luck. So he was never going to be right. So that little group of people, the Jared Bowen, Anthony Gordon or whatever, that'll be a huge part of it as well.
Yeah.
It won't just be about whether you can play or not.
Yeah,
it will be, what sort of fellow is he?
Yeah.
Will he be all right if he gets 5 minutes in a dead rubber somewhere?
Well, pick the player you like leads with me fat beautifully, Martin. Thank you very much for that little
assist. That's what I'm here for.
Lovely cross into the box there. I'm just going to nod this home to our final topic, which is Brazilians in the Premier League. Hamza, our colleague, has written a fantastic piece on the Times website now talking about why there are more Brazilians in the Premier League than ever before. It's a bit of a kind of history of Brazilians in the Premier League. Most appearances by a Brazilian in the Premier League? Anyone?
Fernandinho.
Correct. Tony Cascarino. Very good. Followed by Roberto Firmino, Lucas Leiva, Edison, Willian. They're the top five. But I want to know from you guys your favourite Brazilians to have played in the Premier League. Tony?
Oh it's going to have to be a Liverpool player. They've had a few, haven't they? They've had Alisson, certainly.
Yeah, I knew it would be. I just didn't know which one you'd
Coutinho.
Go for.
Coutinho.
Coutinho?
No, I'm not going to say Coutinho. No, I'm just naming them.
Just naming Brazilian players.
I suppose probably... Yeah, Firmino. I think because he did something very different in his playing style. You know, I could think of Thiago Silva at Chelsea, how brilliant a player he was. But Firmino, for me, was instrumental in how that front three of, you know, you look at Salah, Mane and him, and you think he done all the dirty work and didn't get all the accolades with the goals that the other two got generally, but absolutely set up the front three to be perfectly... matched in every way, shape and form. And I just think he an absolute fan's favourite at Liverpool.
Incredible, you know,
always
teeth as
be.
Well. Incredible,
incredible teeth,
teeth
yeah. yeah.
Loved a no-look finish as well.
Yeah.
Gregor?
I love watching Willian still.
I still love watching him. And like, after what, you know, it looked like his career was coming to a shuddering halt with the sort of, you know, the way he could sort of lost his way at Arsenal, then went back to Brazil and kind of was getting all sorts of abuse directed at his family and stuff. He almost had to flee his home country. And I mean, he signed for Fulham again. Everyone was like, what are they doing here? And he's just, he still looks brilliant. Still got that little spark of pace, like the first yard of pace that can get him a yard of, get him a bit of space to put in a cross or to beat a man or whatever. I still love watching him play. So I would say probably Willian.
Martin?
I think in terms of the best one, because I always loved Fernandinho when he was with Shakhtar Donetsk, I always thought he was their best player. When there was a lot of other players that were getting more publicity and you know, catching the eye a lot more, I always thought Fernandinho was an exceptional player and played a much more attacking role with Shakhtar. But having said that, I always loved watching David Luiz because
for the right or wrong reasons,
the most optimistic centre half you've ever seen in your life. Never, it was Jose Mourinho. I might have told it on here before, but it's Jose Mourinho who wanted defenders. Why Jose Mourinho couldn't get on with David Luiz is his view of football was that forwards had to be optimists. Yeah. You always had to think that the defender was going to make a mistake, that the goalkeeper was going to spill the ball. You constantly had to think something really good was going to happen for you to keep making that run into the... And you can tell the difference between centre-forwards who are natural centre-forwards and those that aren't by the fact that a natural centre-forward will always have that sense of optimism. Equally, Jose Mourinho thought that defenders had to be pessimists. That's why he loved John Terry. John Terry always worked on the basis that something was going to go wrong, that the guy next to him was going to make a mistake, was going to stand on the ball, someone was going to slip over, someone was going to fall over, someone was going to mark properly at the back post. So he was always on his guard for something to go wrong. And that's why he could never get on with David Luiz, because David Luiz had a forwards mentality whilst playing at centre-half. He never thought that anything was going to go wrong. I will take this ball, I will run it into their half. I will not believe for one second that I could make a pass that would go wrong and then they're straight into our back four. And he was fantastic to watch, and every now and then would do something absolutely amazing.
Amazingly brilliant.
It could be either way. And I love that idea of football as a roller coaster, and that's what it was.
Forrest Murillo is an optimist. He's the newest Brazilian optimist defender.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, his first two games, I think, he went these mazy runs and almost scored an absolute worldie from the edge of the box.
Whereas Thiago Silva is that pessimist sort of thing, right? This is all going to go wrong. I will be here just in case anyone needs to be kicked up in the air. And also a mention for Juninho, who was the first in this modern Premier League getting the biggest stars of world football into our league. And I can remember Henry writing at another newspaper. I can actually remember his intro on the day that Juninho signed for Middlesbrough, which was something about lighting the lanterns all across the Yorkshire hills. Brazil's number 10 is coming to England, because that's what it felt like at the time. We've signed Brazil's number 10, even though he probably wasn't quite Brazil's number 10 at the time. I mean, we probably wanted to be Brazil's number 10, but Brazil's number 10 is coming to England, and it just felt absolutely fantastic that Middlesbrough had got Juninho. And then they got Emerson.
Yeah, them two of them, slightly, the Samba boys.
Yeah, the Samba boys.
Could have done the worst Brazilian as well.
Yeah, go on then.
No, I haven't thought one. they're normally all great, aren't they?
Guy called Silver at Man City. They bought a bloke at Man City once that, I mean, they bought the only Brazilian that couldn't trap a football. I mean, it was a centre forward as well. Honestly, you could have. You could have gone to Copacabana Beach, and you could probably have got someone playing beach football that had the skills of Silva.
Well, speaking of good to bad, I'm going to nominate Mario Jardel, who was a player I saw play for Porto.
Yes, a big centre forward.
Back in the day when it used to be on ITV, and I come home from school and I watched him play for Porto. I was like, wow, he's good. His stats for Porto in league appearances: 130 goals in 125 appearances.
Yeah.
He then scored 22 in 24 for Galatasaray. He then scored 53 in 49 for Sporting Lisbon. then went to Bolton Wanderers, played 7 times, never scored in the Premier League. No. Mario Jardel, my nomination for my favourite Premier League.
I think he was probably 2 Jardels at that time. He'd put on a bit of timber, hadn't he?
He had certainly
put on a bit of
timber. There you go. Well, if you've got suggestions for favourite or worst Brazilians in the Premier League, get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Martin Samuel, Tony Cascarino and Gregor Robson, thank you very much for that absolutely fascinating and sprawling show of various different topics. We'll be back on Monday when we might be discussing Kobe Mainoo's international debut.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.